Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today. Thank you for the dulcet strains, Mr. Beethoven. I guess it's Herr Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we're here on this fine Wednesday, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we are here today. I got something in my throat. I have a frog in my throat. Mm. Anyway, we're here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod is the author of many books, such as The Apostasy That Wasn't and Chesterton's America and Four Witnesses, not to be confused with Four Feathers, which somebody else wrote.
And it was supposed to be good from what I hear.
Yes. Well, it was the great inspiration for the guy that made King Kong.
He actually made there's actually a version of Four Feathers that was made by Cooper and Schoedsack.
That's right. Yep. Marion C. Cooper is like one of the just amazing American heroes.
Characters. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He was just an amazing guy. Yeah.
Have you read that biography?
I've not read the biography, but I saw a little movie that somebody made about him.
Document. That's right. That's on the King Kong DVD, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. That's absolutely on the right.
Peter Jackson produced. So
yeah.
Excellent stuff. Yeah. He is a character. There's a full length biography of Marion C. Cooper, who made the original King Kong, and native of Jacksonville, Florida. So when you actually hear him on recordings, there are good recordings of him telling his own story. He's got a very very thick Florida cracker accent.
Yeah.
It's entertaining to me. And he was every kind of adventurer you can think of. I mean, he's pretty much the character of Carl Denham in the movie is a fancy portrait of Cooper done by his partner Schoedsack, who wrote the film, or he and another writer came up with the story and the script.
They drained out his southern accent.
Yeah, he gets a bit more mainstream,
I mean, he was this guy who he was fascinated with airplanes, the movies, and gorillas.
Yep.
And he managed to put all this together and just live this astonishing life. They sent him off to
He was a World War One pilot, a pilot who the war was over, he stayed over and fought against the communists in
he went to Annapolis, I think. And kept telling them, you know, airplanes are going to bomb ships out of the ocean, so you really need to think about airplanes. And they said, get out of here. Right. So he went off and wound up flying in World War One as a pilot. And like two times almost got killed. At one point, his engine caught on fire and the flames were like, you know, roasting his hands. So he wound up, you know, just trying to move the stick with his knees, and he managed to bring the plane in for a landing somehow. And he thought that his pilot behind him was his gunner behind him was dead. But when they landed the plane, he got the gunner out of the plane before it blew up, and it turned out the guy was alive. And then another time he got shot down behind like German lines or something. And he wound up, getting taken prisoner, but then got out, and then he...
This was actually after the war. He was...
Oh, that's right. He was taken prisoner by the Russians.
Took sides, against the communists in Poland, and was put in a horrible prison camp and escaped and...
Killed a guy.
it's quite a story. But after the war, he went out and made motion pictures in jungles and places. Yep. And documentary filmmaker, there were a lot of carnival hucksters who made supposed jungle films, but a lot of it was shot in zoos in Florida and places like that.
Yeah.
And he, but he actually made very significant, records of tribes that don't exist now and all kinds of other things. I mean, good, good films.
Adventure and excitement and a long sea voyage.
That's right.
Yeah, that was
last gasp of the golden age of exploration, really, is what some people have called it, which is really what the King Kong movie is about, his fear that the last great adventure is out there somewhere and he's going to miss it, you know.
Right, right.
And so finding an island full of live prehistoric monsters is the fantasy of the guy who's fearful and bemoaning the that the last adventure on Earth is about to be had by somebody.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was, I think my favorite story about him, after he escapes from the Soviets and gets back to Poland, they want to give him like this big hero's welcome and, you know, shower him with all these gifts. And he's like, oh, shucks, you know, I just doing the right thing, you know? And then, so he just like, blows off all the gifts that the Poles want to give him and gets on a boat. This is where he actually met. He met Shudzak, I think, in Venice or something. And that then struck up a, they struck up a friendship. But then he goes back to the U.S. This would be in the early 20s after he'd gotten away from the Soviets. And I love this gesture of his. It's one of the things that just makes me love the guy. He got back to New York, he says, and he had $2 in his pocket. And so he bought a jacket with $1 and he gave the other dollar to a beggar.
Pretty good.
And that's how he came back to the U.S., you know, after this, already having lived this, you know, more adventure than most of us have ever lived, you know.
Yeah.
He says, okay, what can I do? And he winds up dividing his time in the 20s between making movies with Shudzak, and then he quits that for a while and goes to work for Pan Am.
And it helped start Pan Am, really.
Yeah. And so he worked in New York and he watched the Empire State Building being built out his window. And it's, I love how that just kind of goes into the, it just goes into the soup, you know, while he's living his life and thinking about things. But the other thing that had happened to him that had made a big impression on him when he was a boy growing up was, as we forget that gorillas are like a fairly recent discovery. Gorillas were sort of like Bigfoot in the 19th century.
Yeah, only definitively proved to exist in like 1907 or something.
Yeah, and so it was like a big deal that these mysterious man-like creatures that lived out in the jungle had turned out not to be some native legend or, you know, something like this, but they're actually real. And so he just thought that was super cool, as I would think it would be super cool.
If, well, another aspect of it, too, is they really were thought to be like Bigfoot. In other words, quasi-human.
Right,
and they might have a culture and they might be able to talk in their own language. And in fact, the apes in the original Tarzan and the Apes book, which came out in 1912, I think, are like this. They're more like a missing link kind of Australopithecus type thing than they are a gorilla. And that's one of the things that's made that story hard to translate through the years, because that is not something people know about apes anymore. And so the book's hard to swallow for some folks because the apes are very sophisticated.
Okay,
but that's a side rabbit trail. But gorillas really were thought to be like Bigfoot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so he was fascinated by that. And that's, I think that that's just a marvelous picture of kind of the artistic process at work. You know, you just, you throw all this stuff into the hopper and you jumble it up. Well, let's see, there's the Empire State Building out my window. And I've always thought gorillas were cool. I love airplanes.
After his death, his estate passed into the hands of a family member. And one of the books in the estate was a copy of Gulliver's Travels that he'd had since he was a small kid.
Really?
And one of the illustrations in the book is of Gulliver being held around the waist by a giant monkey. Really? In the part of the story that takes place in Brobdingnag, the land of the giants, where
isn't that interesting?
Where Gulliver is the Lilliputian. He falls into the hands of a monkey at one point. There's this fairy. I mean, obviously, there's the germ right there. You know.
Because
it's duplicated almost exactly in the movie.
That's fantastic. I love that. I remember in the documentary, he said, my life has been divided between airplanes and Hollywood. And so he went out to Hollywood and he bumped into a guy named Willis O'Brien. His friends called him Obie. Willis O'Brien had sort of in fits and starts been doing stuff with, animation, stop motion animation. So he had done the dinosaurs for The Lost World in 1925. And then he was working on some project of his own, which never actually got off the ground. Cooper said, I've got an idea. Dots of your host.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We're talking over the last break. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. If you have passionate feelings about King Kong or anything else, you can just let it rip. And you know what? You know what? Last night was a black moon. Now you may be asking yourself, what's a black moon? Do you know what a black moon is, Rod?
I saw a movie once called Black Moon Rising with Tommy Lee Jones. Not very good. Yes. It was a car in that movie. It was a car, the black moon.
Oh, okay. Now I will tell you what a black moon is.
Okay, please tell me.
A black moon is the second new moon in a calendar month.
Oh, sort of the opposite of a blue moon, huh?
That's right. And so the question is how often does that happen, Mark? Go ahead. Yeah, ask me.
How often does that happen, Mark?
Oh, once in a blue moon. So
I bet the black moon is about equally rare as a blue moon.
I think it is. And somebody was panicking about it yesterday because of deep significance of the thing, that the terrible thing that will happen because it's a black moon. So I don't really set a lot of store by that kind of stuff.
Yeah. To say the least.
So we were talking about King Kong before the break and the amazing career. And by the way, Marion C. Cooper went on and did more awesome things.
Yeah, he sort of helped to invent Cinerama, and he, which is widescreen movies that we
right
for granted today.
And he signed up, at the beginning of World War II, and he was like he was heading toward geezerhood already.
Yeah, right, yeah.
By the beginning of World War II, but he signed right back up for the Air Force, and he, did all this amazing stuff during the war.
Well, they put him in, if I'm not mistaken, they put him in the same film unit that a lot of the great Hollywood types, filmmakers went into. Mm-hmm. There was this legendary Signal Corps unit that was made up of filmmakers, people who made training films, propaganda films, you know, all kinds of things for the military during the war. It included John Ford, Frank Capra, Howard Hawks, Ray Harryhausen.
Wow.
Who was very young at the time.
Right.
Ray Harryhausen had a good buddy during this same period named Ted Geisel, better known to a lot of folks today as Dr. Seuss.
Yes.
So, but there was this tremendous amount of talent that was in this Army unit. And, yep. But Marion Cooper was one of them also.
Yeah. Frank Capra did a whole series called Why We Fight.
Yeah. They're great too.
So, yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, Marion C. Cooper.
So, yeah. So anyway, and he went on to make, The Quiet Man and other, I think he died in the '60s and was sufficiently headed on into geezerhood.
I think that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, just an amazing human. He's one of those guys that you look back on and say, "This is what makes America great."
Right? Yep,
he's a story that could really, I think, only have happened in the U.S. and particularly the U.S. in the 20th century. Just this amazing guy, you know,
one of these mid-century guys.
Yeah, yeah. So someday somebody will make a movie about this guy. But anyway, well,
that biography is great. It's called I'm King Kong.
Okay.
By Mark Cotevas. So if okay. you're interested in reading the biography of Marion C. Cooper, that's the one.
You know, another King Kong related biography that I love is Fay Wray's biography, which has a picture of her being held by King Kong as he's like standing atop the Empire State Building. And she titled it, On the Other Hand.
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
So, and she was not a blonde, but you know, you have to have a blonde in the 1930s. So,
well, you were anyway. going to share a theory of yours about yes. these movies.
So, I have a theory, and I think that it is there's solid evidence for it all over the place,
like almost everything you say, Mark.
Of course. And so it's this. My son and I noticed this, that an infallible rule of science fiction and fantasy movies is that archaeology is evil.
Really?
Archaeology always dredges. Every time you dink around with archaeology, you will always dredge up some eldritch horror.
I see where you're going now.
Open a portal to catastrophic evil. Something bad will happen if you.
And we'll all learn a lesson about better to not touch things that man was meant to leave alone.
Yeah,
right?
There are things that man was not meant to know. Yeah, and so you know, you learn that Babylon 5. If you go to Khazad Dûm and you start doing archaeology, well, you're going to unleash a shadow war. That's what's going to happen. You know, don't. For heaven's sakes, if you're a Nazi, don't open the Ark of the Covenant, you idiot.
wonder if all of this might be rooted somewhere in old, some people would say taboos, but it's also part of our Catholic faith, that mm-hmm. you don't dig up people's graves and put them on display, you know?
Well, that's part of it, although, of course, the Ark isn't a grave.
Well, yeah, but the idea of, I'm saying the whole thing might be rooted in an awe or, again, as somebody might say, a taboo or a superstition about rifled graves, you know, that you're committing an act of impiety if you dig up a grave.
I think there are a number of things in play there. You know, other examples that we can see, Stargate, don't dink around with an ancient Egyptian artifact for having, you know, this is the lesson of the mummy as well, of course.
Right.
There you really are rifling through graves.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention the mummy, and I'm going to bring up one caveat to your generally well thought out theory.
Okay.
You need to think about a man named Edward Van Sloan. He's one of the unseen icons or unremembered, forgotten icons of monster cinema. Edward Van Sloan was a distinguished looking and talking elder man, sort of think along the lines of Anthony Hopkins. He has the role in these movies that Anthony Hopkins would have in the 90s remake. And in fact does in at least one case. In all three of the original great Universal Studios monster movies, the original Dracula, the original Frankenstein, and the original Mummy. Edward Van Sloan is in all three of those films, and he plays pretty much the same character in all three films.
Okay.
The interesting thing is, he plays Van Helsing in the Dracula film.
Okay. Now I know who he is. All right.
And then the Mummy, he plays Dr. Mueller, who is an archaeologist on the dig that turns up the mummy.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing about this particular archaeologist is, yes, he's
By the way, this reminds me.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If you're in Iraq, don't dig up a statue of Pazuzu. Because, again, bad things are going to happen.
Right. Well, in these movies, Edward Van Sloan is archaeologist, scientist, but he's also the guy who warns about all of this, about impiety. In other words, he's surrounded usually by materialists.
Right.
People who say, this is the 20th century,
Right.
It ought to be just fine to do this now.
On a side there, that's got to be the dumbest argument. It's like saying, well, but it's 2:24 in the afternoon.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Those were powerful words that would dismiss and disarm all forms of obscurantism in the mid 20th century is just to say, but this is the 20th century.
So, one of my favorite lines out of Sleeping Beauty is where the prince, the dad says something about, be careful about, dragon.
This is the century. This is the 13th century. Yeah. Yeah. Really good. Really good. But Edward Van Sloan in these movies is a scientist, and he's there to be involved in the project, but he's also there, the one that warns about lines that shouldn't be crossed. In other words, he, in all the case, especially in Dracula and the Mummy, he is a Christian scientist and not in the Mary Baker Eddy sense. He's there, but when his materialist friends are about to step over the line to go from a permissible, licit archaeology into things that man was meant to leave alone, Edward Van Sloan is there to warn you about it.
Okay.
So it's interesting. It's a kind of a Catholic sophistication on the thing. Are Catholics pro-science or are they anti-science?
Okay.
Science, or do we believe in the Bible or do we believe in science?
Okay.
And Edward Van Sloan is there to show that you can do both things. And he's there to sketch out a proper boundary. He's there to be to make things more complicated, but that's always what people who are trying to tell the truth do, they don't give you the broad stroke. They say, yes, we can dig up this tomb and learn what we can about ancient Egypt. But when the curses and all the other things, he takes people out under the stars of Egypt and warns them about things that man was meant not to.
That's right.
And he's the exception, I think, to your rule.
Well, we'll continue this conversation when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett talking about things man was meant to.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. And we are talking about, well, we're talking about kind of an interesting pattern that I have noticed from, you name it, Stargate to, Deep Space Nine does the same thing. Raiders of the Lost Ark, of course, Babylon 5, everything that H.P. Lovecraft ever wrote, you know. The message that you get over and over again, and it was confirmed for me again last night. I was watching. Oh yeah, it was a Star Trek Next Generation episode where they visit some dead world that they've been doing archaeological digs on, and the very first thing that happens. It was kind of interesting. The very first thing that happens is some starship explodes after they've visited this world. And so why did this happen? The curious thing about it was, this is a show that's made in 1988. And for you younger people in the audience, 1988 was BI, before internet. Now there was an internet that was sort of being used by a few nerds and geeks out there. But the internet really doesn't come into its own until the 90s and beyond. So consequently, there was very little in the way of computers talking to each other in popular understanding, mostly because most people didn't even have a computer. But the idea that you got a modem and could talk to another computer was just barely starting to enter public consciousness, and really hadn't entered public consciousness in 1988. So consequently, the shocking idea that the Enterprise has to struggle with is the thought that an alien probe, when it sent its scan and looked at the Enterprise or looked at this other ship, it wasn't really looking at the other ship. What it was actually doing was downloading some kind of computer code, incredible as this could sound, that might in some way infect, if you will, the computers of a starship.
So the idea of a computer virus was a big revelation.
Computer virus is like off the radar. And so, of course, science fiction, although it's constantly about the future, what it's always really about is simply projecting whatever happens to be going on right now into the future. So if we don't know that there is such a thing as a computer code that can screw up your computer in 1988, which nobody in the audience knew at that time, then neither does the crew of the Enterprise, even though they're living centuries in the future.
Right.
And so it's one of, you know, it's something, for example, that you see with one of the greatest science fiction stories ever told, The War of the Worlds. It was a stunning idea. There was this amazing twist at the end of The War of the Worlds that Martians might die from the common cold if they came here. You know, well, of course, we're familiar with that story now for the last century, and so the idea that a super advanced race would come here and make absolutely no preparation for biohazard of any kind is hilarious to us, but it was completely unthought of at the time the War of the Worlds happened. Was written. And so it's one of those curious things that you find is science fiction stories that have this devastating twist ending. It works at the moment,
but maybe not later.
You know?
Anyway, science fiction inevitably dates.
Yeah. So, but you wanted to talk a little bit about Peter Cushing.
Ah, that's right. Well, we talked about in the previous segment, we talked about the role that Edward Van Sloan plays in those early Universal Monster movies, specifically when he's playing a character like Van Helsing, who is a scientific man, a well-educated man, who nevertheless, when he gets among other Britishers who scoff at vampires and mummies and all the rest of it, he still has room for that sort of thing, and he has to step in and tell them that that there's more things, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. So That role was taken over in the late 1950s by another actor, Peter Cushing, who played Professor Van Helsing in the Hammer Studios Dracula movies.
It's easy, I think, because intervening years, I think it's easy for a lot of people to forget. Because the main reason that people recognize Peter Cushing today is because he's the evil Grand Moff Tarkin.
That's right, from Star Wars.
But he played a good guy.
That's right. Dracula winds up in Star Wars eventually, too, because he was played by Christopher Lee in this movie. So yeah. So they both got their turn in Star Wars movies eventually. But, yes, Peter Cushing is a wonderful actor who was called upon to play Professor Van Helsing in the 60s Hammer Studios Dracula movies. And it's a fascinating story. In real life, Peter Cushing was a pretty serious and pretty devout Anglo-Catholic.
Okay.
In other words, not just a believing member of the Church of England, but somebody who had thought through the theology well enough to be downright tractarian in his beliefs. Mm-hmm. In other words, he was a Newmanite, and in other words, indistinguishable from a Catholic pretty much, except in matters relating to the papacy. So, and apparently a pretty evangelistic kind of guy too. Apparently he was quite open about his faith and every now and then felt called to step in and say something in that regard. And they kept giving him scripts when he was playing in these horror pictures in the 60s and 70s. They kept giving him scripts where the religious or spiritual elements of it were obviously written by somebody who didn't have the first idea of what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, being written by non-religious people.
Right.
And one of the reasons that movies like Brides of Dracula and things like that are so good is, well, Brides of Dracula is maybe the first and best example. That was the second follow-up to the original Dracula movie, and they gave Peter Cushing this script to the Dracula sequel. And the way that the vampires are defeated in the script is they call on the powers, the good guys, call on the powers of Satan and black magic to drive the vampires out. In other words, they gave him a script where Beelzebub casts out Beelzebub.
Right. Yeah.
And, he knew that this was all wrong. He knew that this was terrible, you know? Right. And he said, look, I can't do this. This is ridiculous. Who thought this up? Van Helsing would never do or say any of these things.
Right.
And, and thankfully the producer said, look, we don't care. We don't know from any of that stuff.
Right.
Here, you take the script home this weekend and you write it the way you think it should be.
Okay. We're only knocking this thing out on a $2,000 budget. I mean,
yeah. And so, he took it home and completely rewrote it and made one of the most Christian, genre films ever made, probably. In other words, the amount of Christianity in Brides of Dracula would blow your mind.
Isn't that amazing?
It's total. This the it went from that gobbledygook to very astute theological ideas, all put in by Peter Cushing. So they said, fine, let's shoot it this way then. So they did and made a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, whenever there was any kind of religious element in one of their movies, they went to Peter Cushing. They said, look, will you look over this for us? And
I love that.
Now, their best director was a man named Terence Fisher, who also worked on Brides of Dracula and some of that. He too was a pretty serious, believing Christian.
Uh-huh.
And so the two of them were a little bit of a Christian clique within the Hammer Studios, and they had a very great leavening influence on those movies through the years. As the cinema got looser in its willingness to show violence and nudity and things like that, they were there acting still in the role kind of leaven to make sure that there was always a spiritual restraint behind a lot of it. And they didn't completely succeed. Some of the movies are pretty bad later on, but they always had a salutary effect on it. And right up to the day of his death, Peter Cushing was very upfront about his, in fact, he seems to have had a good influence on Christopher Lee too, who seems to have gotten more, more serious about his faith as time went on. So, yeah, but I have a friend named Paul Leggett, who is a Presbyterian minister, who wrote a book about this little hammer clique of, high church Anglicans and about the effect that they had on these legendary scary movies. And it's pretty fun read and pretty fascinating stuff.
Well, you know, I think one of the things, getting back to the whole archaeology is evil trope, that you run into over and over. We'll have to get back to it after the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm the host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett talking about and Eve's technology. We'll be back. Connecting the Dots.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We've been having a pretty fun, geeky,
monsterific conversation.
Monsterific conversation about my thesis that one of the standing rules of science fiction and fantasy, one illustratable with multiple points of evidence from all kinds of different sources, is that archaeology is invariably evil. It's always a source. If you dig around with archaeology, you are guaranteed to just dig up something horrible from the past that's going to unleash eldritch terrors on the world. I think that part of that is that, especially in its roots, in its beginnings, science fiction is focused on the future. And it's primarily written, particularly in the early days, it's written by people with a real animus toward the past, and especially toward the Christian past. And so it has a dream of you know, kind of a future. Well, there are multiple futures forecast, of course. There's the future where horrors engulf the world because, you know, the Martians come and destroy us all or something along these lines. So there's dystopian science fiction. But there's also a real kind of an eschatology where we... you know, we evolve into a higher life form, or we spread out among the stars. This is the great hope that you see, for example, in a Roddenberry science fiction.
Well, all of these things are replacements for some element of the Christian eschatology.
Yeah. Right.
In other words, they're men who, for the most part, many of them were terrified by a bad Christian upbringing.
Right.
That's true in a surprising number of cases. The original founders of written SF, at any rate,
right,
were people who had been given a lot of bad. I mean, Forrest J. Ackerman, who was later became famous for monster movie stuff, but in the early days, he was the world's number one science fiction fan and had fan letters in all of the great fan magazines and all the rest of it. But
right.
He talks about one day when he was eight or something, asking his grandmother some question about the Bible or something and getting whipped for asking. You know, the asking itself was bad.
Right.
And he was told, you know, we don't question stuff like that, you know. We don't. So a lot of these guys, and also there was hellfire and damnation involved too. So a lot of these guys, you know, lost sleep,
right?
Back during the '20s, you know, and thirties,
right?
And so this, for a lot of these guys, it was a quasi-religious endeavor. It was an attempt at heresy, you know.
Well, and you know, and I mean, for you know, somebody like Wells, I mean, Wells really is like an ardent proselytizer and evangelist for his worldview. But what goes with it, I think, and this is just a private speculation of mine, is that there's a tremendous terror of the past that is kind of a leitmotif in these stories. It's remarkable when you get somebody like a Ray Bradbury who doesn't regard the past with fear and contempt.
Right. He's almost unique in that regard.
And,
yeah. And as a result was a little bit of a pariah amongst his fellow. Even though he was nobody's idea of an Orthodox Christian through most of his life. And, but he just liked, he had nostalgia for the past. He was able to do, one of the reasons he and Walt Disney got on so famously was because Walt had this too. He spent a lot of his time dreaming up Tomorrowlands and, making programs about how we're going to get to the moon one day and Mars and all the rest of it. And yet he also, in the same theme park, built Main Street USA, which was the Midwest of his boyhood that he grew up in. So, and he had a foot in both camps, and there was a healing quality to that.
Yeah.
And it worked for Bradbury also.
And so part of just my little speculation is that, you know, when you get rid of the Christian tradition, you don't get nothing. You something else comes to fill in its place. And I think that part of this curious leitmotif that you find in so much science fiction fantasy, in which archaeology is always the sure portal to horrors, is an echo of the fall. There's a sense that there something terrible happened back there. And if you poke around in it, you're liable to wake something up. So just leave it alone.
Well, there's a sense in which these movies are trying to scare people.
Right.
And modern people, by the time these movies were made, were taking a great comfort from the fact that we don't believe in ghosts and devils and monsters anymore. We're not like our ancestors. And yet these movies represent a second thought. You know, they represent, in other words, they're always filled with confident authority figures saying, you know, it must be, you know, a hoax or, you know, it must be mass hysteria or whatever.
Yeah.
And we, the audience, know that it really is real vampires or a real devil or whatever.
Somebody said the difference between, Scooby-Doo and Doctor Who is every Scooby-Doo episode ends with somebody saying, "Why, that's not a monster. It's just old Mr. Higgins in a bedsheet." And every Doctor Who episode always turns on, "That's not old Mr. Higgins. That's a monster."
Well, you know, I think this continued later as well. I think one of the things that gave the movie The Exorcist the power that it had was when it came out, 1973. There's still, you know, 50% of your audience in America was Catholic or fallen away Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since Vatican II, the spirit of Vatican II had been big and getting a lot of press. And I emphasize the quote unquote spirit of Vatican II, as opposed to the letter of Vatican II, which nobody took much interest in.
Right.
But there were an awful lot of people who went to see that movie who had complacently been enjoying the me decade because they'd been released from their Catholic guilt because Vatican II said it was okay.
Yeah.
Not that Vatican II actually said that. So they went to see this movie and they found out that the devil is still real.
Right.
And one of the reasons it's scary is you have to call old Father Marin in eventually.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I think one of the reasons that movie terrified so many people, because historically it came at a time when a lot of Catholics had had given themselves permission to sow wild oats. And the movie was a sober, cold bucket of cold water in the face.
Yeah, I like, you know, the young priest is doing all the psychology. Well, you know, she seems to be manifesting, you know, this personality. And you know, Father Marin is like, the devil is a liar, right?
Yeah. You know, that there's one element of the movie that absolutely is true, and that is the family went to a Protestant minister first.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, the story that the movie is sort of based on is the family went to a Protestant minister first, and the Protestant minister, once he got a hint that it wasn't just easily explained.
Right.
He said, look, you better call a Catholic priest. They they know about stuff like this.
It's all fun and games until somebody needs an exorcist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's true with Dracula, too. You don't call for Pastor Judy at the community church when Dracula comes. You go get the guy with the Romish crucifix. You know?
Exactly. So anyway, I think that that's interesting that you get these curious little echoes in our culture of that curious fear of the past, because in fact, of course, we are the survivors of a primordial catastrophe that shouldn't have happened, but it did. And because of it, you know, we're living with the effects echoing down even to our own time. And in us personally, and of course, this is the great message of another great science fiction story, Forbidden Planet, that, you know, I feel as though, you know, this monster is lurking somewhere nearby.
nearer than you think.
Nearer than you think, Dr. Morbius, you know, but that also is our faith, that, you know, what's wrong with the world? Chesterton was asked. Well, I'm the thing that's wrong with the world. I'm the monster that can destroy the world. And this is the great warning of our faith. And of course, when we hear that, who wants to hear something like that? I'd like to hear, you know, happier.
Right.
News about myself.
I guess it's appropriate before we meet again on this program. It will be October, so I guess it's appropriate we've taken a Halloween-y tone to these things. Maybe we can do a little more of this in the month ahead, Mark.
Let's do it. Good. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our co-host today was Mr. Rod Bennett, the ever enjoyable Rod Bennett. Our producer was Ethan Boland, and I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a splendid evening. Bye-bye.